Just a reminder that we're going to finish up this chapter by reading the case and discussing the case of what I refer to as the drunken law professor on Monday night. And thereafter, we'll do some reviewing of chapter two. We are now at the point where we are, I think, in a good position to try to sum up a little bit of what we've learned about the doctrine of consideration. At least we can get a good start on it. If you have questions as you review over the weekend, please put them up on the forum, or if you hate forums, send me an email, or better still, use that forum that's part of the web. That'll make sure it gets to the right place at the right time. The forum is best, but I'll leave that one up to you. If you send it to me by email, by the way, I will copy it into the forum so that my response is also part of the forum. After we finish, not now, but probably after we finish the next chapter, which is on, or maybe chapter four, somewhere in around the end of chapter three and then chapter four, I'll let you know. I will give you a practice exam question for you to do what you want with it. We'll go over it in class fairly carefully. I don't offer to grade them. I will not do that. But if you'd like me to read afterward what you've written and give you some comments about it, I will do that, just so I don't have to put a grade on it. I've tried for about 25 or 30 years now to figure out a good way of teaching the law of accord and satisfaction. And as you'll discover tonight, I've probably failed. But we're going to try again. Every year I've tried. And I think that the problem is that maybe the law is counterinstinctual. I'm not sure. That could be the reason for the difficulty. Or maybe it's that there's some underlying complexity. But I know that this body of law always creates two kinds of problems. One, in initially being willing to embrace the fact that it exists, and later on, realizing how truly narrowly it has to be confined so that it can't be used to solve everything. So I want to make clear that we're going to talk about accord and satisfaction. It is a doctrine which is applicable in circumstances, in limited circumstances, where we're talking about modification of a contract. And I think part of the problem lies right there. I had to diagram it, for those of you who like diagrams. I would say that the field of modification of contracts is quite a large one. There are lots and lots of legal doctrines that are potentially applicable to it. We're looking at one of them, of course, pre-existing duty, has an impact on your ability to modify the contract, because if it's one-sided modification, like in the Lingenfelder situation, the court will say, no, that's not a successful enforceable modification. There was no new consideration being offered by the architect, and therefore the promise to pay the architect more for essentially the same work is without consideration. Accord and satisfaction belongs down in here somewhere. I don't mean necessarily at the bottom, but it belongs as a subset of the doctrine of modification. And it does involve changing, modifying an existing contract. And the most important thing I'll say all night is this. It belongs in here. And it belongs subject to the pre-existing duty rule. The fact that it has a different name and it's not called a modification of the contract shouldn't throw you. It is a form of modification, and it has that one basic component in common. That is, for that particular modification, now called an accord, for an accord, in order to be enforceable, it must be supported by consideration. And since it's in the context of a modification, it has to be new consideration. That is, it can't be just a repetition of the same consideration, and it certainly can't be less than the existing duty created by a prior contractual agreement. Okay. You're going to see why I said that, I hope. Let's look at McMahon Food Corporation versus Burger Dairy, the one sort of major accord and satisfaction case that you have in this work. Ms. Young, tell me what exactly was the problem between, or problems between, the McMahon on the one hand and Burger Dairy on the other? And not only were they returning the cartons for credit under contractual arrangement, but how about there were some other cartons too? Is that correct?
Milk cartons from other companies?
Yeah, milk cartons from other companies, and their agreement included their possibly returning some of those, not just returning, but delivering some of those when they returned their other cartons, the cartons that did in fact come from this milk company. So, what was the nature of this agreement? Was it, do we know whether it's that they thought they should get credited for more in terms, or?
Yes, they thought they should get, that they weren't getting credit for all of the parts that they returned.
Okay, so they were getting bills from milk company that they thought were incorrect because they failed to show adequate credit for milk cartons returned. And then what happened?
They were taking the credits themselves,
shorting the check. Oh, I see. So they made payments in which they simply gave themselves the credit that was not reflected on the invoice. And you can imagine with what joy that was received. So what happened?
Burger Dairy Co. and McMahon Food Court met to discuss the bill. They really didn't come to any agreement about a past due balance. It was like $50,000 was their past due balance. And then there was a new manager of Kirby Burger Dairy Company who again met with the McMahon Food Corp representative, and he was told that past due balance was all settled.
Yeah, we had a change in leadership, right, over on the part of the Burger Dairy Company. And that change in leadership apparently led to some part of this issue. So, McMahon Food Corporation tells his fellow, what's his name? His name is now Bilsma. Right? Bilsma. Tells Mr. Bilsma, oh yeah, well, we settled that. And was that true?
No,
that was not true. Or at least the seller says it's not true. And does the court think it's not true?
The court agrees with Burger Dairy Company.
Yeah, that's right. See, the only thing that's important really for us is what the court believed the facts were. Obviously, if we were trying this case from scratch, one of the major evidentiary questions would be what was agreed to and not agreed to. And it makes it more difficult because the person who allegedly made the agreement never told his company that they made the agreement. There's no evidence on record, on paper, that they made the agreement. And he left. So you can imagine the factual problems that that might create when you get to the trial level. But by the time we come here, it's settled. the court treats this as settled, that in fact there was no settlement. Okay, so what did they do? But they told them there was a settlement. So what happened after that?
He wrote a check to them, not for the past due balance that they had settled, but for a new month. It was June.
All right, so they wrote him a check, right, for newly existing transactions that are post, or after the transactions that have been subject to their earlier dispute. And they were paid, right? They wrote a check for it. Anything special about that check?
He wrote on the bottom, payment
at all. Right, and that's where our problem is, right?
Yeah.
That's the, at least that's the first step as a matter of law. We read through all the facts, we say, all right, here's an issue. Because what ultimately happened with that piece of paper, that negotiable instrument we call it, it's a check saying we pay so-and-so this amount of money. And then what happened to that check?
They deposited it.
Yeah, ultimately it got deposited. That was probably a mistake. And it happened, again, because of, there's some internal communication problems in this company, clearly. It's not as well organized as it should be. And so the person who deposited it sort of didn't know about any of this history. But what did they do before they deposited it? So they didn't just deposit it. They didn't just endorse it. They have to endorse it. They didn't just endorse it, that is, put their name or the company's name under this language, paid in full. They did one other thing.
The accounting manager crossed out paid in full and wrote without prejudice?
Yes. They scratched out that language and said without prejudice. So one of the problems in law that this raises that doesn't really get much discussed in this case is what is the legal significance of scratching out language that the payor, the person who writes the check, writes on it. You scratch it out and then you endorse it. What is the legal effect of that? In most states, the answer is zero. Has no impact. It doesn't matter. They endorsed it. The courts are going to treat them as having endorsed it the way it was written, not the way in which they tried to change it. You can't unilaterally change an instrument. You can refuse to endorse it. You can refuse to deposit it. You can return it as unacceptable, which is, by the way, what they should have done. But striking that language is irrelevant. So the court has to confront the question of what is the legal effect of saying, of their endorsing a check, forget that scratching it out, the court's going to ignore it, of their endorsing a check that says in full payment. So what does the court say and why? Just about that one check. We'll talk about the other one. What about this check?
Illinois had a statute that they applied for a court of satisfaction, and they found that under the plain language of the statute, in order to establish an accord of satisfaction, or the burden of establishing that it met the criteria of the statute.
And which, and what criteria did it fail to meet? More than one. Anyone will do for the moment. The criteria did it fail to meet? Good faith, or rather the absence of bad faith, whatever you want to call it. And they found that this was not done in good faith. Why was it not done in good faith? I mean, what about it was other than good faith? What about
he lied about the debt had been settled. He now lied to the new
okay,
business.
So you have a background lie, because he had said this has really been settled when it had not been. And then you write in full payment when you know perfectly well that it can't conceivably be in full payment because it's only a payment for this current debt and doesn't touch the earlier, February, I think, the earlier debt that had been in dispute. So the court felt that was not the thing. Was that the only problem with it?
Qualified enough to decide if this was really a full and final payment.
She wasn't qualified enough?
Well, she wasn't, no, it was, she wasn't the one to make this decision to accept that check in full and final payment. Because she wasn't the initial controller of the account.
Well, that's interesting, but should it be relevant as a question of law here about the impact? I mean, there may be some problems with inside the company if she did something she shouldn't have done because she was not authorized to do it. But she did it, and it affected the payment. They deposited the check, and the check was collected.
I don't think there was any other issue. If it hadn't been in bad faith, that would have been accepting it.
I don't think so.
But there was, because it was something that was in dispute, and you can't just write, if you know that this is in dispute, you can't just send an instrument like
was
that.
Was there, in the view of the court, a good faith dispute about the question of whether or not there was any prior debt owed? Was there a claim that was in dispute between these companies?
Yeah, no, right.
In good faith, in dispute?
At the time that he wrote the check, it wasn't anymore because he had told him it was paid. So when he accepted the check as paid in full, he wasn't aware that the dispute still existed.
But he was, because he scratched out that language.
No, that was a different person. That the person who took the check and accepted it as paid in full was the guy he lied to.
Well, interestingly enough, receipt of the check is probably not, at that point, any action on the part of the recipient. Probably there's no action on the part of the recipient that's legally meaningful until they take that check and deposit it. That is, they could have the check, hold the check for a while, and then send the check back, and the court would not treat it as though any legally significant action had taken place, because the form of acceptance of a check in payment occurs at the moment of deposit. No reason for you to know that, but that happens to be the set of rules that govern negotiable instruments, which is what this is. Every time you write a check, that is a negotiable instrument.
But when he gave the check paid in full, they were also looking at the invoices that were no longer part of that February debt, and that's what was included with the check that he gave him. So that's what the controller would have had when she cashed the check. She would have been looking at the check as that debt, not the disputed debt. So wasn't there a question as to that still being a disputed debt in
there? Right. So the problem may be in part that the processing of the check was not done with the issue of that prior debt in mind at all. And was there anything beyond the language written on the check to give them, to alert them to that fact?
They had those other invoices, which is what the check was made to cover.
The invoices that they had were, of course, the ones for the
new ones.
Transactions subsequent to the February debt.
Right.
This is the second, they're the brand new ones. And so that's not saying very much. So would it have mattered? Let's imagine that they did a little bit better than this. They said, in settlement of all disputes, including the February invoice.
Then it would have been the conspicuous statement. It would have clarified that it was everything.
So maybe that should have made a difference, though. Maybe.
Is part of the issue that by them simply writing it, they're making a unilateral decision that they've decided, even though they haven't had a conversation, that it's equal satisfaction and accordance, or satisfaction and accord?
It would say positive.
Yeah, we would say accord and satisfaction.
Sorry.
That's right. The reason we say it that way, by the way, is an accord. Is agreement. It's like coming to a contract, agreeing on a contract, that's the agreement. The word satisfaction translates into performance. So just as we don't say, oh, performance, and then say agreement, we don't say satisfaction. So, we have two different issues always with respect to these sorts of agreements, including the check that is said to be in full payment. If you look at this from the standpoint of treat it as though it were a traditional contract arrangement, the tendering of a check that says in full payment is an offer of a contract, of a contractual agreement. It is an offer. The acceptance of that offer would actually be the act of depositing the check. That would both be the performance on the part of the offeree, and would also, by the way, ordinarily be the consideration. It is an agreement formed by a promise and an act. The promise designed to induce an act. But of course, the problem is that in order for that to be enforceable, and when I say it to be enforceable, I mean now the agreement is not just, oh, here is the payment, now deposit it. I'm offering this to induce you to deposit it, but also, and if you deposit it, that is a release of all other claims you have against me. So, if we have an agreement, an accord, the accord is the act of payment or offering payment. And now the question is, all right, well, like any agreement, it has to have consideration. So exactly what consideration is being offered by the payer of the check here? The buyer. What consideration is the buyer offering?
Well, none in regards to the February debt.
None. No. And why is the answer none?
Because they're not paying for it.
They're not paying for it. They're not paying for any of it. The check that they're writing is a check for writing for the newly existing transactions, the later transactions, not the February invoice. So we have a problem. One of the ways in which courts sometimes find the existence of consideration is, let's suppose that there was an existing acknowledged dispute between the parties about the amount that was due and owing. So we can imagine this is slightly different facts. We can imagine that instead of lying, if it was a lie, instead of saying the bills were, oh yeah, that's been settled. He said to Bilsma, well, that one is not yet agreed on. We've had some lengthy conversations. We've had some disagreements. Our records and your records seem to be in disagreement about the number of cartons that we returned for which we're entitled to credit or entitled to payment. But I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to send you this check, and it will cover the full amount of the present debt, the new invoices. And I'll send you a check for 50% of this amount because I doubt that you and I are going to be able to come to an agreement. You're new here, and I know that your paperwork is wrong, and I know that my paperwork is right. You disagree with that, but we have a disagreement about it. And so what I'll do is, in the interest of having peace between us and continuing our wonderful business relationship, I'll pay you 50% of that February invoice along with payment for the newer transactions. And they say that in a letter, and the check also says, accepting in satisfaction of all pre-existing obligations, of all existing obligations that we owe you. The court would look at that and say, well, there's a dispute about the February, and assuming that they found it was in good faith, that there is in good faith a dispute about the February invoice. And the parties have come to some kind of agreement. There is consideration because each side is giving up its claim. The buyer claims that in fact they're entitled to much more credit than that. The seller is saying they're entitled to much less credit than that. They are coming down with some figure which represents a willingness to give up some part of the claim. That's consideration. And therefore, there is consideration. Even though you're paying a lesser amount for a greater debt. So if you go back to Folks versus Beer and imagine that there was some disagreement between them about the actual face amount of the debt, that let's say instead of being a clear-cut amount that was due, it was a reasonable payment for a service, and there was a disagreement between them about what the reasonable value of the service was, the court would have found that the agreement they made had consideration, because each side would have been giving up part of its claim. The lender would have been giving up claim for credit, for interest. The other side would have been giving up, the borrower would have been giving up credit for his claim that he really owes less because the service was less or whatever it was that he received. So the issue here is a search for consideration. Good faith, of course, plays a role in this. Because in order for there to be a dispute that is getting resolved by the settlement, the dispute has to be one in which each side believes in good faith that its claim is justified. And they are giving up that justified claim in order to reach an agreement. And that's where you find the consideration. You can't find it in the amount, obviously, because what's being paid is less than what at least one side says is owed. But when you try to do that this way, that is when you try to write it out, say, in full satisfaction of, and you do it when the court finds that you're not in good faith proposing a settlement, because in fact all you're paying for is the later, you've previously lied about whether or not any amount was due before, or whether it's settled. Therefore, you don't have a good faith dispute, and so nothing you write on the back of that check is going to have any impact at all on the underlying question, which is, do you still owe the rest? Because the way the important satisfaction works, the real importance of it comes after the satisfaction. After the satisfaction, the person who had a bigger claim, who claims they were entitled to more, now brings an action against the other party saying, okay, that's fine, you still owe me. Just the same way as the student Folks versus Beer. Fine, you've paid me all the principal, now I want the interest. The defense is, oh, well, you gave up the interest, that was the agreement. Well, yeah, but there's no consideration for that agreement. And if there's no consideration for the agreement, it has no impact. That's the way these go. So your question is always going to be, where do we find consideration? In that respect, a court in satisfaction, although it occurs in a very specific kind of circumstance, is really very much part of the overall question of modification of contract. And just as modification requires consideration, so too does the accord require consideration. And the fact that you have satisfaction of the accord, so what? If the accord did not have consideration, it will not have the impact that the party who made the payment really wanted, which was to be discharged of the balance of their obligation to the party who has, quote, accepted the accord, accepted the satisfaction of the accord. can you do that by writing on the check? Well, not alone. Now, they tried again, right? Come back to you, Ms. Gardner. They tried a second time, right? And what did they do this time? How did this one differ?
They gave two more checks, and they
wrote some about another, another check. And then what is different about the way in which they did this one? Anything?
Well, the fact that there were two checks, one got sent payment in full through 8/15/92, and I believe the other one didn't say payment in full.
Did the check say on it, payment in full? The second transaction.
Well, they attached the voucher to the check. They didn't write it on the check. And then in the last line, I guess, whatever they wrote, they put down full and final settlement, full and final payment.
You'll find in the facts of the case and find out where it was written. August 18th. A voucher accompanying each check listed the invoices being paid and the deductions whichever MFD was making. The voucher accompanying the second of the two checks dated August 18 bore a list reflecting that MFC was paying off three specified invoices and also deducting $1,758.46 for bill cases for which MFC believed it should receive credit. Typed in capital letters at the bottom of this list was the notation paid in full through 8/8/92. Berger immediately deposited both checks without further inquiry, as well as a check the following week for an August 15th invoice, whose accompanying voucher also included a line saying payment in full through 8/15/92. She said she received and deposited the two checks without noticing the payment in full language on the attached voucher. She added that it was her habit to examine the checks themselves, but that she ignored the memos or vouchers accompanying payment. So what they did is, the second time in August, they wrote it not on the check, but on a voucher accompanying the check. What does the court say about those? What's the court's analysis of that particular problem? So on one of the August 18th check, but not on the other, and it's not on the check that's issued after that. August 15th invoice.
That they didn't make it sufficiently clear to make her aware that that's what they were doing?
So now we have another requirement, right? We have a requirement of clarity. So where does it have to be? What would have satisfied the court?
On the check.
Well, on the check, and what would it have to say? You know, you can have contracts in which you have a promise or an offer on one side, and you have simply the other side just takes an action because there's an action requested rather than a promise. And so a contract can be formed that way, as we'll see. We've seen a little bit of that already. That's a promise for an act. And the act is the act of depositing the check. That represents the acceptance of the offer. But there's a problem, the court says, about it. And the problem is in the area you've identified. That is a lack of clarity. So the question is, well, what would it, under these facts, what would it have to say? Why is there a lack of clarity in all this?
I mean, there were
check that was less than the invoice because they disagreed about, again, about the amount of credit that they were receiving for the returned milk cartons. So let's suppose that they get an invoice, and the invoice says, you owe us $1,000. And they look at it and say, no, we returned some milk cartons, and the milk cartons were worth under our agreement $100, and so we only owe them $900. So they sit down, they write a check for $900, and they say, in full payment. So forget all this earlier stuff. How about that? Write that in there. Is that enough? After all, if she only looks, if she never looks at the invoice, but only looks at the check, and it says $900 in full payment, does she just assume that that's the full payment and she signs it, she endorses it, and deposits it?
She doesn't know she does.
Or do we have to, does it have to say, well, in spite of the fact that I am writing a check to you for less than your invoice amount, this is issued in full payment for her. Contract, of course, just says so much per truck full or so much per carton. It doesn't say the amount that's due and owing. That is a function of the invoice, which is an invoice that is written, presumably, accurately, reflecting the agreement they reached. So the agreement reads in terms of so much per carton of milk, or so much per case of milk, so much per truck full of milk, and then whoever does the invoice says, oh, well, it was three trucks this month, three times whatever the truck amount is, and that's the invoice. And presumably, on the invoice, they should have, under this contract, minus whatever the credit was for the number of empty cartons that were returned. But that would have been the way in which they invoiced. Can they really sit there and say, oh, well, this isn't enough notice when it says in full payment for the invoice dated so-and-so, would that be enough? But she never looks at the invoice. Do you have to say, this is not the full amount of the invoice, but it's the amount that I owe you, offered in full satisfaction of?
That sounds good.
Don't they have to have the invoice and send a check or make that agreement with the person that they're in dispute with? Because that person has knowledge of.
Well, wait a second, we're dealing with a company here. I mean, if you receive a telephone bill, you have a disagreement. Who is the person who did what? Who you made the contract with when you became a telephone subscriber? Or obviously, the business part of this is done by some office, not the sales part. It's done by the record-keeping part. And alas, the processing of the check may very well be done by still another part. That's the bookkeeping part of the company, which is different than the invoicing part of the company, which is different than the sales part of the company. And then there's the boss who plays golf every day, So here's the problem. Even if it said this is offered in full satisfaction of this month's bill, would there be consideration? You're offering a lesser sum than the sum that the company said you owe. No consideration there. Well, then the only other form of consideration in any of these cases is going to be, was there a good faith dispute about the amount of so. Now let's suppose that we answer that, well, here are our records showing we returned 25 cartons, and here's your invoice which only gave us credit for 5 cartons. But we have a disagreement about this. Or does the law require that they actually write a letter which says, we're not going to pay you the full amount of your invoice because we think your records are wrong about the number of milk cartons that we returned to you. Our records show that we returned 25. You've only given us credit for 5. So here's a check that reflects our records, rather than the invoice you sent us, which reflects your records, with which we disagree. If they had done it that way, if those had been the facts, they had done it that way, we would be far closer than they were on these facts. None of that, of course, would have touched the February indebtedness, which remains unresolved between the companies, obviously, until some court decides it. Now, when does this occur? It almost always occurs as some form of, that is, a court dissatisfaction. It almost always is an end game. That is, it's generally the circumstance in which one side has completely performed, and the other side doesn't think, well, either they don't want to perform, or they don't think that the performance that they've received, although it's completed, they don't think it satisfies the obligations that that side had of the contract, and therefore, you don't feel that you have to pay, or at least you don't have to pay at all, the total amount, because what you received is not adequate. So, you buy something at a store, and you write out an IOU for it. Payment is due in 10 days. You take it home, you use it, you're unhappy with it. You think it's not adequate, it doesn't equal the meet the description that it was given when you bought it. So you take it back, you say, look, I'm not going to pay you the full amount because it's not what it's supposed to be. I'm willing to pay you 90% of it. Take a 10% discount because it's not really everything it's supposed to be. That at least would be an offer of an accord. I wouldn't expect that to be a satisfactory offer from the standpoint of the seller. Okay? But it's an offer of an accord. If the seller agrees, I'm assuming that you held that view in good faith and you had a reason for saying it didn't meet the description of the seller of the good, then the court would say, all right, well, this is a compromise of the disputed claim. And therefore, it is consideration. And therefore, if the seller accepts it, you're obliged to pay that 90% of the price to the seller, and the seller has to release you from your pre-existing obligation to pay 100% of the sale price.
You're going to pay 90% for something you're
retaining.
Is that what you're saying?
I use 90% just as a compromise of a claim. That's all. You're paying less than the full amount. You're offering to pay less than the full amount.
But
you're offering to pay.
Are you keeping it? Pardon? Like, are you keeping it?
Yes.
Or are you returning it?
Yeah, no. You're not returning it. Returning is a whole different game.
Okay,
I'm talking
that's
about
what
returning
you're
it.
Me,
no, you're keeping it, but you're saying, but it's not worth the full price. I told you I'd pay you $10 for it, but in fact, this is not worth $1/8.
If they accept it.
Because it's not everything you said it was.
If they accept it, it's okay, but if they don't accept it, then it's not okay.
Then you,
right?
That's right, then you owe the 10.
This reminds me of one of my coworkers paid for some landscaping work at his house, and the bill came in at $2,400, and he sent back a note that said that he thought it was only worth $2,000. And that's what he sent the check for. The check got cashed, but the landscaper sent him a notice he was going to take him to court if he didn't pay the extra $400.
You see, that if the general rule would be that if that was a good faith dispute he had, that is, he has a basis for arguing that it was really worth, that it wasn't the $2,400 job he was promised, then he'll win. If he can't persuade the court that this was a good faith dispute over the amount, then he's going to lose. It's not the best way to do it, obviously. The best way to do it is to establish the fact that there is a dispute between the two parties. The way you do that is by writing a letter saying you failed in your landscape design to take care of the following three problems which you said you were going to take care of, therefore it's not, you're not entitled to the full payment. But I'm willing to, you've already done the work, willing to accept the work that you've done, but I'm only going to pay you portion of the payment that I contracted to pay you because you didn't deliver to me everything you contracted to deliver. But yeah, that's an example.
So are you saying before?
There are.
I paid before, I do. White man. So.
There are some instances in which courts will never accept it. Just in case you were thinking about doing this to a telephone company, for example, in all those circumstances where the court is aware of the fact that you know that nobody who knows anything about the transaction is in fact going to the person who processes that check, the courts will not find that the processing of the check represents an acceptance of the accord. So, in a way, I'm assuming this is a very small business that you're talking about, most landscapers are, and therefore the court would not make that assumption. They make the assumption that somebody at the receiving end looked at it and was in a position to compare it to the invoice and to make a judgment about whether or not it was acceptable, whether or not it was full payment, among other things. This has been so troublesome a part of the law that the folks who are responsible for the Uniform Commercial Code, we've talked about Article 2, and that's pretty much the only article we're going to talk about. But in fact, there are many other articles. And one of the articles deals with negotiable instruments. That's Article 3. So you will find, and I apologize for not posting this before, if you had looked at the book, you would have seen a reference to Article 3 in the case book. And what I've done, if you look under Resources and Supplement, you'll find Article 3 excerpts. The one to look at is 3.11. Accorded satisfaction by the use of instrument. Here, instrument means negotiable instrument, not a torture instrument. And you will find that, although some people feel that way about negotiable instruments, you'll find that if you look at A, it will tell the story. There are many other provisions, but notice A. If a person against whom a claim is asserted proves that that person in good faith tendered an instrument of the claimant as full satisfaction of the claim. 2, the amount of the claim was unliquidated, I'll explain that in a moment, or subject to a bona fide dispute. And 3, the claimant obtained payment of the instrument, the following subsections apply. In good faith, tendered an instrument to the claimant as full satisfaction, the amount was either unliquidated or subject to bona fide dispute. We've talked about bona fide dispute. Unliquidated means that the agreement did not involve cash. So let's suppose that I had a contract with my doctor, a bartering arrangement with my doctor. My doctor provided medical services for me in exchange for which annually at Christmas time I gave my doctor a very large pick. So the pig was in payment for an exchange for medical services. The pig is unliquidated. Not that he's not dead, but that he's not cash. So 1 year, I just can't get my hands on a big pig. You know, so it's like the apple in the mouth and all that stuff. So I say to the doctor, I'll tell you what, if you don't have a pig to send you, I'll send you a check for $500. Well, if that's accepted, there is consideration, because what we've agreed to is a liquidation of an unliquidated debt. My debt is a pig. That's not liquid. It's liquidated when we decide on an amount in lieu of the pig. So whenever you have an agreement for an amount, when the original agreement was not for amount but was for a service or a good, the court will say, aha, well then, because you've agreed upon a liquidation of the unliquidated amount, that's where the consideration lies.
You say cash, do you mean cash and cash equivalents or just currency?
I mean something that is easily quantifiable.
Like a money order, would a money order be?
That's cash. It has to be one which is not identified in our case, dollars. And that does sometimes happen, because of course there are agreements, let's say, that I pay in advance for service. The service is an unliquidated amount. If we then get into a battle about it and you offer me something in lieu of the service, let's say you offer me a different service. So you were supposed to mow my lawn all summer. I'm really unhappy with how crappy a job you did because you never cut the high grass around the trees. And you say, oh God, I'll tell you what, the first three snows of the winter, I'll do the shoveling for you. That would be an enforceable accord of satisfaction, because the amount in controversy here is a non-liquid amount. It has to do with the quality of your lawnmower. And it substitutes for another non-liquidated amount, but a different non-liquidated amount. Therefore, the court would say, oh well, there is consideration. So it's not just if there's a dispute, although 99% of the cases you'll ever see arise because there is a dispute between the two parties about the adequacy of the performance by the party who says that they've completed the performance.
So what about the, when you see on TV, like, settle your credit card debt for, you know, half or whatever, that would never actually work if it went, so there's never really any consideration
That's
in
right.
like that.
That's right. Remember I said the last class, that one of the big surprises to lawyers is the fact that this rule exists and that it means that the regular practice of settlement, frequently in a context in which there's not really a dispute, just one side just can't perform what they said they had originally performed, technically speaking, those are not enforceable. Now, some of what the credit card companies and the banks are doing now is under some federal regulations, which makes a difference. And some states have some statutes which change this, at least in some segments of the economy. But the general practice of settlements, where it's not in the context of this dispute, those settlements are in fact non-enforceable. Let me talk about the non-enforceability for a second, because that's the other issue to talk about that's sometimes troublesome. What does it mean when we have a court? What's the status? Let's say the status fact is not yet taken place. You and I have a dispute about some service that I rendered, and you were supposed to pay $100 for that service, but you don't think that I did a very good job, one more, so you say, I'll offer you $85 for it, and I'm being generous, and I'd say, okay, let's settle for that. I'll settle for that. Well, will you pay me? Oh, I'll pay you on next Monday. Okay, I agree. We have an accord. We don't have satisfaction yet. The satisfaction is supposed to be next Monday. So the question then comes, okay, things can happen between now and Monday, right? So one of the things that can happen is you decide not to pay me. You said you'd pay me $90 in settlement of our, you know, payment, and you don't pay. So here probably it's going to be easy in this particular example, which one you choose, but nevertheless, as a matter of law, I have to ask this question. Can I sue for the 90? Or can I sue for 100? Remember, my claim was 100. You disputed that I'm entitled to 100. Said I'm only entitled to at most 90, and you were willing to agree on 90. Can I sue on 90, or can I sue on 100, or do I have my choice?
100.
Okay, well, we're here until Monday, and nothing happens. Before Monday, if
can't sue for anything. On Monday, you don't pay me. At this point, there's a breach. There's a breach of the accord. So here we have a case of, this is referred to frequently as obligor breach, that is, you were obligated to pay me money and you didn't pay. So the question is, an obligor breach, can the obligor still sue? Suppose I wanted to sue for this amount. I've said it's 90, but let's say instead of dollars, it's something else. It's you're going to perform some service for me. And I prefer to have that service than to have the $90. I'd rather have $100. Can I sue still for $100? So courts are in total disagreement about this question. The traditional view was you could not sue on the accord. So that what would happen is if the accord was not satisfied, if it was a breach by the obligor, I could sue you only on the original agreement. The full modern rule is that I have my choice, and I can sue on either one. If I prefer the accord, I can sue for breach of the accord. If I prefer the original agreement, I can sue for breach of the original agreement. If I sue for breach of the accord, then I'm not entitled to sue for breach of the original agreement. I have to make a choice. But the choice is mine. Another question that's come up might surprise you, and that is, how about if it's an obligee breach? Obligee breach. That is what happens is that you tender to me the $90 on Monday the way you said you would. I refuse to accept it. What then? Under the ultra rule, the traditional rule, because an accord by itself could not be sued upon, the courts were reluctant to allow the obligee to argue based upon the accord. But modern law, applicable almost everywhere, is that you could use it, in effect, to force me to accept the $90. That is, you go to court and you have a defense against my attempts to get $100 from you. So that, in effect, the courts are forcing the obligee to accept the performance of the accord offered by the obligor. That's relatively new. This is in the last 50, 75 years. Courts have finally come around to that point of view. So there is some significance of the accord independent of the deal. Once you have an accord, it is a legal entity, it's a legal being, and it has some consequences for both the obligor and the obligee. The obligor, a little less so, they have a choice whether to sue to enforce the original agreement or the accord. The obligee, they have a mechanism by which they can force the original creditor to accept the amount that they said they accept in the accord. That is, that they would accept the accord, but accept the performance of the accord, or as we now say, satisfaction of the accord. But though this is all fascinating, what I mostly want you to remember out of this material is what often lawyers forget. And that is that accord and satisfaction is a species of modification. And that the basic rule, there are exceptions, of course, but the basic rule is that there has to be consideration. Now, this won't surprise you. There's one other twist, and it's a twist you see in the case book. And that is, well, what happens then if you have an accord and between the moment of the accord and the moment of the satisfaction of the accord, the individual relies upon it? There's no consideration, but there is reliance. So you and I don't really have a dispute about it. You say to me, well, I'm just not going to pay you the $100 I owe you, that's all. I don't feel like it. I'm not going to pay it. There's no dispute. Saying you don't want to pay is not a good faith dispute. And I say, okay, well, and then I make some sort of offer of settlement. You rely on that offer of settlement. And you rely in a way that was foreseeable. There's no consideration, but the accord becomes enforceable by you because of your reliance. So knowing that you are going to, if you can pay me the $50 that you really want to pay me, knowing that you're going to take that, that's going to alter your behavior in ways that I know or have reason to know. You're about to do something in reliance upon this agreement that you only have to pay me $50. Just as in other instances of Section 90, if we can show that the promisor, I promise to accept $50 in lieu of $100, right? That the promisor made a promise, which the promisor should have reason to believe will be relied upon by the promisee and is relied upon by the promisee, the promise becomes enforceable. So just as any other problem, any other promise that we talked about could potentially fall within Section 90, so too can the promise in an accord fall within Section 90. And if the court finds that it does, it will be enforceable in the absence of consideration. Because remember that Section 90 can work to do the same job that consideration does, that is, reliance, if it meets the criteria of Section 90, can justify, can support the enforceability of a promise.
But what an example of that be? Like, how would you prove you relied on?
Like, in your case book, there's a case in which a party goes out and take Sugar House Finance versus Anderson, case on page 142. There's a Sugar House has a judgment against Anderson. Anderson doesn't satisfy that judgment. They settle it after Anderson tells Petty, and maybe this was duress, says, look, I'm going to declare bankruptcy, and then you're going to have to process your claim in bankruptcy if we can't come to settlement. Knowing that, they decide to settle. They settle for a fraction of the amount. There's not really any dispute about whether the amount is due or owing. But what happens is, in this deal, the way it's settled is that the debtor here says, Anderson says, look, I'm going to go and borrow money in order to pay you off. And he does, in fact, go and make the arrangement to borrow the money, and then, of course, Sugar House decides against it. He doesn't like it. He wants all the amount, but so he doesn't want a fraction of it. And the court says, no, you can't back out. In effect, the court is saying, look, that's an accord, and the accord is enforceable. But why? There's no consideration. There was no dispute about the underlying claim. It was a judgment of a court of law. But the court says, yeah, but there was reasonable reliance. And reliance, which in this case the promisor did know about, because he told the promisor what it was going to do. And he said, that is reliance, and reliance makes it enforceable under the doctrine of Section 90, or as the court says here, promissory estoppel. So that's an example of how Section 90 could, in fact, be used to support an accord. One other matter for the evening. As the law moves, the law is moving fairly rapidly toward getting rid of this requirement in its entirety in the law of modification of contracts. Of course, if it disappears in modification of contracts, it will probably also disappear in the law of accord and satisfaction. Because, you know, the mama bear is is modification. This is just the baby bear, it's the accord. Two signs of that. Number one, 2209(1) of the Uniform Commercial Code. Article 2, section 209(1) of the Uniform Commercial Code. What does it say? It's cited in your case book, on page 143. What does it say?
An agreement modifying a contract within this article needs no consideration to be binding.
Bye-bye consideration. Interestingly enough, there's nothing in Article 2 which requires consideration. But Article 2 doesn't really deal with what is necessary to make an agreement, to make an enforceable agreement. It deals with a lot of other stuff, but not that. It leaves that to common law. But with respect to modification, they wrote 2209(1) saying, oh yeah, if it's a transaction in goods, which the Uniform Commercial Code Article 2 applies, then no consideration is required for modification. The reason they did it, of course, was that business people regularly modify their agreements. And they were uncomfortable with this rule that says these modifications are not enforceable without consideration. But then you say, what about cases like Jungenfeld? So what they did is they wrote comment, for what it's worth, to 2209, an official comment, which means nothing, by the way, because the legislatures don't enact the official comments. To my knowledge, only one legislature in the United States ever read the official comments. Legislators didn't read it, but New York has something called the Law Reform Commission, which you may know is a body associated with the state legislature. They read it, but the legislatures don't read it, and they don't enact it. But what it says is, oh well, the modification has to be in good faith. Why? Well, because there's a general provision of the Uniform Commercial Code that we'll talk about next semester, which says that all performance of contracts have to be in good faith under the Uniform Commercial Code, under Article 2. You have an obligation to perform in good faith. Once you make an agreement, you have an obligation to perform that agreement in good faith. So they said, that is a pervasive obligation, and it certainly applies, and particularly applies, to modification. So the court can put you to the task of identifying how it was in good faith to make this demand for modification of the contract that you made and got agreement to, and now the other side is unhappy about the agreement, doesn't want it. You have to show that it's enforceable because doesn't have consideration, doesn't have to, but you have to show that it was done in good faith. That's instance one of change in law. Instance two is in 89A of the Restatement of Contracts. That's also cited in your case book. And more to the point, I suppose, is that it's the subject of Angel versus Mary. So I'm not going to talk about Angel versus Mary, but what I want you to do before Monday, because we will talk about it on Monday, is I want you to make sure that you read 89 very carefully. It has been a not universally successful suggestion by the drafters of the Uniform Commercial Code, but it is a number of jurisdictions, including obviously Rhode Island, in Angel versus Murray, have accepted it as part of their common law. If you look at 89A carefully and then think about the relationship between 89A on the one hand, how's it like and how's it different than 2209. The other point, before we move, is if you haven't looked at it yet, you may want to look at the provision of the CISG, Article 29, which is cited on page 143. That is in your supplement, by the way. The CISG is the last document, the very end of the Byrne supplement. The CISG, that stands for Convention on the International Sale of Goods, and it's applicable to all transactions in goods where the seller and the buyer are citizens of signatory states. and most of the major commercial countries in the world are signatories to the CISG. It was created by a UN body, and it's approved by the legislatures of the various states as a treaty, but in fact, it is a code of conduct very similar to Article 2 of the Uniform Commercial Code in connection with sale of goods. It does not apply to consumer goods. It applies to all other transactions in goods. Unlike the Uniform Commercial Code, however, the parties, if they want to, can get out of the applicability of the CISG by including in their agreement language which says this shall not be bound. You will not be bound under this contract of the CISG. And that was regularly the practice for the first decade or so of its existence. But it's been around now for a little over 20 years. And by and large, most international transactions for the sale of goods are now actually governed by CISG, which is why we're going to talk about the CISG from time to time during the course of this year. So you might want to look at Article 29, which looks very, 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 very much like 2209-1 and has the same effect. That is, it says the parties can modify any agreement, but they have to modify it in good faith.